Any deacon? Well, the result, if you fix it, is that it's going to work as a clock. All right, guys, last week we dealt with the Trinity, stepped into a little landmine about versions and stuff. I was wondering if y'all had any questions about that, all that last week before we start a new subject. So you all understand the Trinity well, and you understand the argument about it. I don't know. I know that I could talk about things like that for hours and hours, but when I see people's eyes glazing over and my wife snoring, I think, I better wrap it up and switch it up. So, you guys are the first to see this copyrighted production of my itinerary. No one else in the world except Todd has seen it. Yeah, I have been studying it for years, looking at the, I was going to do a survey of the Gospels. You do a survey of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and that's pretty much similar. And then, of course, you throw in John. And so I just decided to go ahead and bring my itinerary. It's classified. It's highly secret. Nobody knows about it. And it's really not finished. But anyway, what I did was I started reading the Gospels and just started noting, writing down where it says where he is or what time of year or any kind of clue about the time of year or the feast that's nearby. I just started putting all this stuff together and recreating an itinerary of Jesus's ministry. This is similar to a Harmony of the Gospels. I don't know if you've ever read any Harmony of the Gospels. There's a bunch of them. Would you do me a favor and sit over here so I can see you? I don't know why I feel like... You're the best looking one here, so got to be able to see you. Anyway, if you've ever read Harmonies of the Gospels, they sort of have to make some choices. They say, okay, we're going to take Matthew as chronological and the rest of them, or we sort of fit them in. And there are some serious, you know, chronological discrepancies in the Synoptic Gospels. And so you think, and if you read all these different harmonies, there's a bunch of them, you can get them online for free, they're all over the place. And these, they go through the trouble of, you know, dividing it up between the circuits that he did and the tours that he did around Galilee and all that. But, it seemed to me that they weren't focusing on the right information. And so when I did that, I just took it all and started looking at where it said, anything that would say where he was. And then I decided I would see if taking them all as accurate, everything they say is accurate. None of them are just, you know, guessing. They're all telling you what they know. And taking them all as accurate and seeing if it would all fit. And it just sort of fell into place. Everything lined right up. And I explained how I calculated it. If one of the Gospels doesn't mention a time or a connection to some other event or something like that, it just looks like a standalone narrative, then that would not be chronologically necessary in order. You would not be necessarily following. And if the other Gospels did put that information in there, then that would take priority. And when I did that, everything started lining up and falling into place. And so then I lined it all up this way, and I've got the table on the right-hand side, let you know where I'm getting my information and what the reasoning is why it's there. But let me just go ahead and first start off with the calculation of when, you know, what year this is. Because we're talking about, you know, A.D. something, or when was Jesus born? Was he born in... I've heard it said he was born in 4 B.C. That's Bishop Usher. And of course, that Dionysus or Diogenes or whatever the guy's name was that came up with our present day Julian calendar, where the year zero was supposed to be when Jesus was born. Well, it's obvious that we could calculate by other things he wasn't born in 0 BC or 1 BC. He was born, obviously, while Herod was still alive, and we know that Herod died. Josephus says Herod died in such and such a year, which turns out to be the 4 BC, and he died between a certain eclipse that happened and the Passover of that year. The eclipse happened on the 29th of March. I've got that information in there, or March 13th. 29 days before. So right in that month period between that eclipse and the Passover of that year, 4 BC, Herod dies. We know Jesus was born before that. Because, you know, Herod's the one who killed all those kids. And so we don't know how much before that, but Herod killed kids after inquiring diligently, 2 years old and under. So he went out and found any kid under 2 years old and killed it. So we know it couldn't have been 2 years prior to that when Jesus was born. So, you know, what I'm just guessing is that Jesus was born the year before Herod died. So he was born sometime in 5 BC. That's my best guess. Now, it could be as early as 6 BC. But I don't see any way it could be as early as 7 BC. But the problem with making it 6 BC or any older is because Luke tells us he was about 30 years old when he began his ministry. And we have other markers that tell us when he began his ministry. Anyway, I'm going to get to what I consider the interesting stuff. I've divided the ministry of Jesus into 20 periods, 20 spots. I didn't get them all included in your divisions on your printouts, but you'll see them. And the reason why I'm saying this is because Jesus was born at 5 BC, of course, I don't think he was born at Christmas time on 5 BC, which would only be like 3 months possible. In fact, we know that Herod died in March the 13th, or after March the 13th, so sometime in the last part of March of 4 BC. And it's entirely possible that Herod did all this stuff that he did, you know, 6 months before he died. So he could have done all this stuff, killing the babies and everything, as early as 5 BC. And so Jesus could have been born early in 5 BC or late in 6 BC or something like that. Now, the reason why this is interesting to me is because you start calculating out the 30 years after that. Remember, there's no year zero. So it goes from 4, 3, 2, 1, and then it starts 1, 2, 3, 4 on AD. They messed up. They didn't put a year zero. They didn't know Arabic numbers at the time. All they knew was Roman numerals, and there is no zero in Roman calculations. So the Arabs had that figured out. And we understand the idea of zero. But when they made up the Julian stuff, they came up, or when they made up this other calendar, deciding what year and how to call the years, they didn't make a year zero. So there's 5 BC, 4 BC. You just calculate it all up, and he turned 30 in 26 AD. Now, the reason why that's interesting is because over there in Luke chapter 3, you can read it. I'm going to read it because I'll quote it wrong. In Luke chapter 3, Luke gives us very specific information. It says, now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, and he tells us that Pontius Pilate was, he tells us who some other people there, Lysanias or something like that. These are historical markers which allow us to say, okay, this is when it happened. Tiberius Caesar, His reign begins officially I wrote it down here somewhere. It's in the first little paragraph of the actual chronology. It could be no later than 28 AD. So his 15th year would have been counted as 28 AD. Now, kings would count their first years and all that strange. Sometimes their first year that they reign, they'd count it as their accession year. And then the first full year they reign is counted as their first year. It depends on how they're counting. There's no way to know with absolute certainty, but the latest it could be is 28 AD. He also began reigning along with his father as co-princeps in 26 AD. So that's how I count it. 26 AD calculates correctly with Jesus' 30th year, and 26 AD calculates correctly with Tiberius Caesar's 15th year. That means I started off on AD 26. Now, you guys know how the synoptics were written. You've heard of the... Has anybody here heard of the synoptic problem? Have you noticed when you read Matthew and Mark and Luke, have you know those are called the synoptics because they're written from the same point of view? Have you noticed that those three use almost the same wording quite often? I mean, it's exactly the same wording. And so scholars think that they copied each other. First they thought they copied Matthew. They thought Matthew wrote first and they copied Matthew. Well, then they come up and say, no, that can't be because Luke sometimes is a little different or Mark is a little, and they've done this calculation. They have done this now for 150 years arguing over who copied who. They've come up now with I don't know what they are anymore. But the idea is that Mark wrote first, and Matthew and Luke copied a lot of Mark's because they have such identical wording. It's strange. If they had written completely isolated, just each of them sitting in their own desk and wrote something out, it would not have come out that identical. The wording is identical. It's like they are getting this information from something. So, but they can see that Matthew has new information and Luke has new information that Mark doesn't have. Mark almost has nothing in it that the other two don't have. And the other two abbreviate Mark. So what Mark includes, he gives more detail, and they include what Mark has with less detail. All of that doesn't make sense to me to say they copied Mark, because they would have copied all of the details in my sense. It doesn't make sense that they copied Mark. But then they say, so you have Mark is the first gospel. Then you have the M source. No, then you have the Q source, which is where Mark is getting some of his stuff. And then you have the M source where Matthew gets his stuff. And you have the L source where Luke gets his stuff. So they think that there were gospels written before Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or not John, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke, other gospels written that we've lost. And these copied those sources, and that's how we got our books, and that's how they all so similar. It doesn't really solve the problems. It does not clarify all of the issues. It's a real problem. But there is one hypothesis that does clarify everything, and that is that the early gospel was oral and became memorized in its narratives. So if you take the gospel and divide it up into like little stories, you've got the story of his birth, you got the story, you know, of his time in Capernaum. And these are stories because he healed a woman that was bent over, and he healed this leper at this one mountain, and he healed the people at the tombs, and he did these are all standalone narratives. You'll see they come to a spot and then they start up another narrative. And after these things, he did this, and then after that he did they do that, and you can divide all the gospels, the synoptic gospels, into these narratives, these little stories. And you'll find some of these stories are almost identical, or their wording is almost identical, but not all of them. And all of them have new information or what have you. And then, of course, you read Luke chapter 1, and he says, look, I know all of these stories, and I know the order. I've researched it out. I know the order. I have a more perfect understanding, and I'm going to set it all down to you in order. And he does. And you find out his order is almost identical to Mark's order. He adds more information, but it's almost identical. Matthew has some differences in the order. And what happened was, at the beginning, the apostles told these stories. And they got told over and over again. And back in the days before writing was so, where people were not literate, everybody had to remember things. And they would remember the stories word for word almost. These stories would get a certain structure in them about, and all this story, everybody who would tell these stories would recount them with the similar structure. They wouldn't vary very much from that structure because that allowed them to make sure they keep all the information. And the listeners, if they'd ever heard that story before, might even pipe up and say, you forgot this one part of that story. And that the guy that's doing the story would say, you're right, I did forget that. And it became, what happens is the stories become standardized. They become memorized and standardized in an oral form, not written. And we know they weren't written. Even Luke said at the first they weren't written. We knew these stories. And he says, then some people, many, have gone to the trouble to write the stories down. That's Luke chapter 1. Let me read that. See if you see the same information. Luke chapter 1. In the very first verses, for as much as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, even as they delivered them unto us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus, that thou mightest know the certainty of those things wherein thou hast been instructed. Notice, people were writing down what they already knew. They knew the stories, and they were writing, these authors were writing down what they already knew. And because they're writing down what they already knew, you know, all they really have to do is put it in order. So that's why you get a similar, and Luke says there's many of them have tried. But all we have is Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Those are the ones we have. And Luke says many have tried. I'm assuming he's including Matthew and Mark there. But they already knew the stories. Almost everybody, this guy Theophilus that he's writing to, he knew the stories. He says, you already know the stories. We believe them. They were told us by the eyewitnesses. Everybody's heard them, and they're obviously in a very structured, official form. Now, what he's doing is, I'm writing them down in order. Now, you see how this works, is how the Synoptic Gospels, taking a bunch of authentic stories that they had heard, and these men are putting them together in a narrative form, sort of chronologically doing, almost like what we're doing when we try to put these together. They're making a harmony of all these stories. And so they have to ask questions. Okay, when he fed the 5,000, where were they? Oh, they were in Bethsaida, and they walked out of Bethsaida, and they went there, and they have to add this stuff up, and they ask the right questions, and they've got sources for these questions. Matthew was his own source. Mark, they say he got his information from Peter because of the stuff that he includes in there. Only Peter would know. And Luke, they say he got his information from Mary and who else? Mary, the mother of Jesus, because he puts stuff in there only Mary would know, and a lot of times gives her point of view of the thing, which is very interesting. So he got direct information from Mary and what have you. But anyway, if you accept this premise, this hypothesis, that it was first oral, and as far as I'm concerned, it's not even a hypothesis. Luke said, you already know these stories, and people have been writing them down in order, so to make it, you know, easier for us or whatever. He says, and I'm going to also write it down, but the stories were already known. So if you take this hypothesis, there is no more problem. There is no difficulty understanding all three synoptics. None of them copied anybody else. None of them had a book over there of official sayings, and then they wrote it out and burned that other book. We lost it. If there was another book, we would not have lost it. Christians would not have lost that thing. And these are the books. The thing is, all these stories were spoken and memorized, and so they're all putting them together. So when you get a story, say, about how Jesus, you know, did the blind men. One of the ones, I think it's Mark says there's two of them, or Matthew says there's two of them, and Mark says there's one of them. And they're hearing the story from a different apostle or a different eyewitness, and so they just write down what they know. Or Matthew was there, so he remembers that there were two people, but somebody else got the information. All of that sort of lines up with eyewitness testimony being written down by these scribes, these people, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew was an eyewitness, so we assume he's the one who authorized that one. I don't know that he wrote, but scribes wrote it down with his blessing. And then Mark, of course, he may have been around Jesus even before Jesus rose again from the dead, because Barnabas was there from the start, and he was right there. He even mentions some young man that during the night when they took Jesus, Some young man ran away from them naked. The guy grabbed his coat and he let the coat go and he just ran away naked. I don't know why he's only wearing a coat, but But you know, it's got to be cool at night. But some people will say, well, that must be him. I mean, why would he put that in there? And a lot of authors back in the day would put a biographical account in their own little thing, just like John the Apostle writes in there and says, this is the disciple Jesus loved, or whatever. It's their own biograph. It's like their signature, and this guy might have done that. And so Mark might have actually been part of that, all those occurrences. So anyway, almost all Christian scholars think Matthew and Mark were written around in the year 50, 55, something like that. So we're looking at 25 years from the death of Christ to the first writing down of the apostles. I personally think it happened earlier than that, and I heard Michael the other day say he also thinks it happened earlier than that. I don't know what he's basing it on, but I'm just basing it on how widespread they'd become, and even Paul, before he's written anything, is quoting Luke. So something's going on. These people had written. The only one that they don't think was written before the scholars, experts, they don't think Luke was written before AD 70. Can you guess why? Why would scholars think Luke was written after AD 70? Destruction of Jerusalem. But why Luke? Why not the others? You got to understand the mindset of these so-called experts.
He prophesied it.
In Luke, it says, Jerusalem's going to be destroyed in this generation. He says, weep not for me, but for yourselves and for your children, because all of these things, it's going to happen in this generation. And you know, what does he say? If they've done this in a green tree, what's going to happen in the dry? All of those specific prophecies found in Luke happened in AD 70, and experts don't think that it was prophesied, so they say it must have been written after 70, and they wrote it, sort of forged it, in to try to pretend he had prophesied it. It's just pure unbelief. That's why you don't even have to listen to them. What? Those specific prophecies are not in Matthew. Luke's the only one who does it. But we have evidence that Luke wrote before AD 70, because he actually tells the book of Acts, which came after the book of Luke. It's the second one of his volumes. That book ends in AD 61. And maybe AD 63, if you want to count the 2 years that they was in prison. But he says he spent 2 whole years in his house or whatever. It's AD 61 or 63 or something like that when he's in Rome, and the book ends abruptly. Says he was, and so that's when he had it written. He wrote it up to that point and stopped. Either Luke was killed or you know, it got away from him, or who knows what, but it stopped. So we know that Luke was written by around 63 AD at the latest. And that means the prophecy was written down long before it actually happened. Anyway, you have all three Gospels written before the 60s, or around the 60s, and maybe as early as 45 or so, 49 or so, I don't know. They're just guessing as far as what exact year. But the Synoptic Gospels were written pretty much one after another, and some of them had already gotten a little bit famous, and I'm assuming that's Matthew and Mark. They were the most famous. And Luke wrote a little bit later and said, they've already done it, but I'm going to do it. Now, if you take all of these three, getting their information from separate sources, and they're putting them together and trying to make them in order, then you think, all right, let's compare them. And you compare them, and you have to be blown away by how accurate they are. Now, there's always the possibility that someone later saw the differences and sort of rearranged them to make them more and more similar. They call that harmonization, where people are trying to improve their readability or whatever, and they say, well, Mark has this in order. And so if they are so harmonic, they're very much in alignment, it might be because of shuffling later on. But that is a lot of work to copy things in a different order. I've tried it with the book of Jeremiah. It's not easy to do. So maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. But if it didn't happen, if they really did get this stuff separately, and to me the evidence points that they did, It is an amazing alignment, because the only real, I mean, the only significant big difference is in Matthew. And I'll tell you how that works. Just a real quick overview. I've got 20 different periods in there, and you will find one period called his Capernaum ministry. Let me see there. It's the seventh one. It's in your page 4, down at the bottom. Calls it the Capernaum ministry. That was before. Let me see. That's, yeah. What happens is Matthew writes about Jesus moving from Nazareth to Capernaum at one point. And it's just a brief mention. He says, okay, he how does he say it in Matthew chapter? I just find it so fascinating when I first started noticing this, that one will be very cryptic and another one will give the information. Look at Matthew chapter 4. If you look at verse, let me see. Okay, verse 12. Now when Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, that's a marker. Pay attention to that marker. Jesus heard that he was cast into prison. He departed into Galilee. Now that, what does that mean? He heard that John was cast into prison. He departed into Galilee. That means he left Judea where he was. It doesn't say that in Matthew. We find that out by John. But here it says he departed into Galilee. And we only know that he's in Galilee because of John. Here it says he was tempted by the devil. It doesn't say where. Matthew doesn't give us the information where. Except that he was baptized, and we now know because of John that that was in Judea. But Jesus says he goes into Matthew says he goes into Galilee, and verse 13 says, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the sea coast. All right, Capernaum. We heard Stephen say that was the city of Nahum. Capernaum. I did not know that. And I don't know if it's true, but Capernaum. What? That's got to, you know, that ought to just shock you a little bit when you stop and think about it. Why did he leave Nazareth? And why did he move to Capernaum? Those are two big questions. We know why he left Galilee, because John was cast into prison. That's what he says. When Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, remember, well, you don't remember because we haven't talked about it yet, but John mentions that John the Baptist was preaching over there on the other side of Jordan. That means on the east side of Jordan in Bethabara. New Bibles will say that was Bethany, Bethany beyond Jordan. And that's, you know, maybe, I don't know. It doesn't matter. They don't know where either one of those cities are. Anyway, he was preaching over there in Bethabara and on the other side of Jordan. And Jesus came back from his temptation, stayed there a while, was dwelling there, had a bunch of disciples. He begins preaching, but then they both moved on this side of Jordan and they're preaching in near Salem. And they have some interaction, but they both have huge followings. So you have Jesus with a huge following and John the Baptist with a huge following, and Jesus is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and John the Baptist getting less and less. And all that stuff that's mentioned over there in the book of John talks about how, you know, that his disciples, John's disciples, are getting a little bit upset and says, he's baptizing more than we are. What's going on? They're all going with him. And John says, well, that's what's supposed to happen. I'm supposed to decrease. He's supposed to increase. That's what's supposed to happen. Then, bang, he gets thrown into prison. John doesn't mention that he gets thrown into prison. He says he was not yet in prison at one point, but he never mentions when he got thrown into prison. Matthew tells us John was cast into prison, and that's why Jesus left Galilee. Think about it. They're both in Judea, over there near Jerusalem, north of Jericho. They're over there in that area, and they've got man, it is happening. They got huge crowds. John the Baptist was a huge prophet. And then Jesus comes, and Jesus' crowd is even bigger than John the Baptist. It's a monster thing. And he up and leaves and goes to Galilee. And you think, well, what's going on? Well, it's clear. They got so big that the Jews decided they were going to stop it, and they went and arrested John the Baptist and put him in prison. And they say the reason why that all happened was because of John the Baptist was criticizing Herod. Telling Herod, you know, you the Levitical law doesn't allow you to marry your brother's wife. You can't have her. And that's irritated. The King of Kings don't like to be told things like that. So anyway, but what you have here is little tidbits of information that you have to expand in your own mind and your own thinking. Now, verse 12 again of Matthew 4. Now, when Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, he departed into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the seacoast in the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali. Remember what happened over there in John chapter 2? Jesus was preaching in... John is a fascinating thing because he puts a whole lot of this early ministry of Jesus right in the first chapter. And so let me point out how it happens. Jesus is in Nazareth. He's working as a carpenter. He turns 30 years old. And John the Baptist, apparently he had turned 30 years old too, 6 months earlier. And John the Baptist is now famous. He's over there on the other side of Jordan preaching and baptizing. And Jesus up and leaves Nazareth and goes to John the Baptist. And John the Baptist points him out and says, that's him. That's who I've been preaching about all along. And then Jesus leaves and goes and gets tempted. And he's 40 days tempted in the desert. Then it doesn't say how long after that, but he says he comes back. And he goes back over there. And I believe it's at that time now. I think he's still back over there in Bethabara. He goes back across the Jordan River and starts helping John, or I don't know, being part of that big ministry. And then he's pointed out again, and he gets a bunch of disciples starting to follow him. He starts becoming famous. It says he winds up having more disciples than John the Baptist himself. And then John gets put into prison. And then Jesus leaves Judea. Oh, and by that time, they had switched and gone over the other side of Jordan. It's a very interesting little story there. But anyway, then they leave. But you remember, in all of that, it says that Jesus met a guy named Andrew and a guy named Simon, and they were from Bethsaida, and Philip was also from that city, Bethsaida. That's interesting. And the reason why it's interesting, here he has these disciples here, and it says he goes to a wedding in Cana of Galilee. So while he's there ministering in Judea, he goes north and meets his mom at a wedding in Cana of Galilee and does that first miracle. And it says after that, they went up and spent some time in Capernaum. Now that's a curious thing. They go from Cana, and Capernaum is not right there. It's all the way on the north side of the Sea of Galilee. So they go all the way up there and spend some days in Capernaum. And who knows what they were doing there, but his mom went with him and everything. And then he goes back down to Judea, and he starts preaching there again. Has this huge following and what have you, goes on. John's cast into prison. He leaves Galilee. And then Matthew just real truncatedly says, so he leaves Galilee, and then he left Nazareth. He left Galilee, and then he left Nazareth. Well, you see, there's two leaving there. Means he left Galilee, went back to Nazareth for some time, and then leaves Nazareth. And that's all made clear if you read the other Gospels. For example, I think it's in Mark, but it says it's in Luke. He goes to Nazareth. When John's cast into prison, he goes to Nazareth. And as his custom was, he goes in there and he goes into the synagogue and he starts teaching or he starts reading, and then he makes this outlandish statement: today this has been fulfilled in your ears. In other words, I'm the one that this is talking about. To preach the acceptable year of the Lord. It's a messianic prophecy. And the people in Nazareth get angry. And it says they take him over to a hill. Over there in Nazareth to this day, you can still go see that cliff that they wanted to throw him off of. They carry him up to this hill and they're going to throw him off of it. And somehow he gets through the middle of them and leaves. And that's when, well, let's read it in Luke. Because Luke says it just a little bit different. Matthew says, leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum. Luke says, And if your eyes are glazing over, I'm sorry. This stuff just fascinates me to death. I can't get enough of it. Says, where is it? Where is it? Is it over here? Oh, that's okay. It's in Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4, it says, let's see. Okay. Verse 28, and all they in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath, and rose up and thrust him out of the city, and led him unto the brow of the hill whereupon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong. But he, passing through the midst of them, went his way, and came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and taught them on the Sabbath days. Notice how Luke doesn't say he moved. He didn't say he up and left his hometown of Nazareth, where he'd grown up all his life. 30 years he had lived there. He knew everybody there. His family was there. His brethren were there. And his sisters were there. Because he visits it one more time after this, several years into his ministry. And he mentions his brothers and, people are there. And it's a curious thing. It says he just goes to Capernaum. It's like these people in those days, Luke and Matthew and all, they knew all this. And they just overlooked telling us this, like, information. Says he says they tried to kill him, and so he leaves there and goes to Capernaum. But there's more to that story. He left there for permanently and began living in Capernaum. He rented a house in Capernaum and starts living in Capernaum because his hometown of Nazareth tried to kill him. You have to put these synoptics together to get that information. And you got to get it from all the different gospels, because we wouldn't know any of this stuff if it weren't for John telling us how his ministry began in Judea. So what we have here, and I'm going to just outline it very broadly for you. It's still 3 o'clock. I keep looking up at that stupid thing, that clock. Boy, if only we had some deacons around here to fix that. Anyway, broadly, what happens is you find him. He starts off by getting baptized. Then he goes and he gets tempted in the wilderness. Then he comes back and begins serving with John the Baptist. Then he goes to the wedding in Cana, visits Capernaum. He's got disciples that are from Bethsaida, which is a stone's throw away from Capernaum, all up there on the same side of it. And apparently, those were pretty good sized towns in those days. They might have actually been, border towns, because they're right together they're on the opposite sides of the Jordan River, I think right up there at the top where the Jordan River goes into the Sea of Galilee. Anyway, and we don't really know exactly where they were, because the lake levels are different now than they were back in those days. We don't know exactly how big it was back then, but apparently Capernaum was on the seashore also, and now the sea is a little bit ways away from Capernaum, so it's drier now than it used to be. But anyway, okay, he goes up there and visits Capernaum. He goes back down. His mom goes back to Nazareth. He goes back down to Judea and begins his ministry, becomes extremely famous. John gets cast into prison, so he leaves Galilee. He goes up and he travels through Samaria and talks to the woman at the well, and has a revival there. With several days he stayed there because they begged him to, on his way to where? To Galilee. And when he gets to Galilee, he goes back to Cana. And in Cana, a fella from Capernaum comes all the way from Capernaum to Cana to talk to him and say, help me out, my servant is sick. And he says, okay, your servant's healed. And he just goes back up there to Capernaum, and he found out his servant was healed. And then he goes on to Nazareth. They tried to kill him in Nazareth, so he just moves. He says, okay, you rejected me. And where does he move? He moves to Capernaum. It's like he's been setting up. He's got this new, focus, a new center of influence, where he gets up at Capernaum. He's got a bunch of disciples that are from there. And he just goes up there, rents a house, and starts teaching on the Sabbath days in Capernaum like he was in Nazareth. Notice how his huge ministry in Judea, he goes up and preaches in a bunch of cities in Galilee, and then goes over and makes a permanent move to Capernaum. And that's where we get to what I call number 7. I don't know if y'all have numbers, but it's called the Capernaum Ministry, and it's an extended period of local ministry. And the reason why I wanted to talk about that is because beginning with this Capernaum ministry, Matthew in chapter 4 says Jesus left Nazareth and moved to Capernaum and starts ministering in Capernaum, starts talking about his preaching, his messages, and then Matthew steps right in to what we call the Sermon on the Mount. Now the problem is, and it might be in order because the Luke also mentions the Sermon on the Mount more or less at that time. But although Luke says it was on a plain and Matthew says it was on a mount, so I guess there could be a plain up on top of a mount. I don't know. But that basic teaching becomes the introduction of Matthew to Jesus' doctrine. But if you will look, you will notice that the order that Mark and Luke follow almost precisely, exactly, you'll notice they just go from one verse to the next. It's exactly the same order in Luke and in Mark, but Matthew just jumps around like crazy. I don't know if you can see it. Look at the columns there on page 4. Everything is sort of in order with different information all the way down, but you get to the Capernaum ministry, or actually even the second Galilee tour where he goes around healing. It goes from Matthew 4:23, which is where he's going around Galilee, becomes famous in Syria, Decapolis, and all that. And then he jumps down to Matthew 8, where it says a leper in a certain city publishes the miracle everywhere. And then in the next one is in Matthew 9, Capernaum, after some days, he heals a palsied man. 9, then look, it jumps down to chapter 12. On the second Sabbath, the Pharisees criticize the disciples for eating corn. Then it goes back to Matthew 10. Then it comes back down to Matthew 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount. You see how the order is really out of order? And the reason why I put it that way is because Matthew and Mark are identical. Look at the things in Matthew and Mark. They just identical right down there. They just go the exact same order. And they also include little things like, after this, the next day, or just always has these little connections, narrative connections, where it's clear they're saying, okay, this is what happened after that, and then when that happened, this caused this to happen, whereas Matthew doesn't have that. Now, that to me is interesting, because you have to look for the order that Matthew has in his Capernaum ministry. And the order that he has, I have it detailed in, I think, the introductory paragraphs. I think on page 1. Okay, let me see. Nope. Page 2. Well, I'll tell you as soon as I find it. I'm going to tell you why. Matthew has a different type of an order. I wrote it down here. It's in page 2 on the second paragraph. Somewhere in there he says the intentional order you have is, first of all, he opens up with Christ's doctrines. Opens up with the Sermon on the Mount. That's his doctrines. Then he finishes up with the parables. In this whole Capernaum time, he starts with his doctrines and he finishes with his parables. Those are his two big doctrinal treatises. And that's how Matthew writes them. But in between there, he says, okay, I say, he builds his fame in chapter 7. He has a, I'm sorry, 5-7, no, wrong. Builds his fame with miracles in chapter 8 of Matthew. He begins a dispute with the Pharisees and scribes in chapter 9. He organizes the apostles' traveling ministry in chapter 10. And then he recounts he sent the apostles out, by the way, separately. He didn't necessarily go with them. And then in chapter 11, he talks all about John the Baptist, because John the Baptist gets killed, and it tells about him. And then, of course, you have a final utter alienation of the Galilean scribes in chapter 12. Then his parables finish it out. And that's the part of Matthew that is not chronological. But you can see an order. It's like these chapters have a purpose that's not necessarily to put it in a chronological order. Whereas Mark and Luke are putting it in chronological order.
But after 12, Matthew is chronological.
from chapter 14 on, 13 has the parables. Chapter 14 on, all three synoptics follow almost exactly the same order. One place that it's different is in, what was it? It's over there toward the end when he goes to Bethany. But he has it, they have it way off. And I can see why that also. I'll get to that eventually. I guess the point here to be made is that that has confused people since forever trying to make harmonies of the Gospels. In fact, some of the harmonies of the Gospels follow Matthew's order, and it really messes up Luke and Mark. But Mark and Luke are almost identical. Look at them. Watch. Follow them down. They're almost identical all that way. And then after Matthew 14, all three of them become extremely identical. Now, what becomes difficult, and actually I think it's very informative, is how we fit what John puts in. Just let me point out, Matthew, Mark, and Luke have almost identical information, with Matthew's being a little bit out of order in those chapters. But other than that, they're all very similar. Except that Luke includes about a 6 or 7 chapter ministry that the others don't mention. They call it, the experts call it his gnomology, with a G, gnomology. Anyway, this gnomology is Luke's. If you'll read what it says, he says he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And so he leaves Galilee, finally, it's his final thing. He leaves Galilee and starts heading toward Jerusalem, but he goes all over Judea. Not Galilee, he's going all over Judea like he had done in Galilee. Remember when he left Judea, he goes up into the north, and he has several tours, I think 3 or 4 different circuits, where he just up and says, okay, we're going. And he goes, and he goes all the way up to Tyre and Sidon one time. He goes over to Decapolis one time. He goes on the other side of the Sea of Galilee one time, Gadara and all that. Talks about these tours that he does. And one time he actually gets back over to Nazareth. He covers Galilee by preaching. And he sends the apostles out to different cities. And he's covered Galilee. So when he's getting ready to die, he goes down into Judea, and he does the same thing to Judea. Sends his disciples out, and he goes out, and they go to all these cities in Judea. That's found in Luke. I think it's chapter 11 through 17 or something. That part is not mentioned in either of the other two. It's not mentioned in Mark. It's not mentioned in Luke. All they say is he left Galilee to go to Jerusalem, and then he gets to Jerusalem. That's all it mentions. It starts mentioning where they come up from Jericho, you know, the blind man there, I guess, on the side of the road of Jericho. To me, that's just fascinating. Luke includes all this information about a tour that he did in Judea and goes into great detail. And so many gospel harmonies will try to take those chapters of Luke and try to fit them into his earlier Galilee ministry, not realizing that's not what it is. This is a Judean ministry, and they don't fit. By the way, that's why they say these synoptics are hopelessly confused, because some similar things happen in Judea, similar arguments, similar things, but they're not exactly the same. You can look and see they're different. And when you take a harmony, you say, okay, this story is the same as, sort of the same as this story over here, and you try to mix it up, it just gets hopeless. It gets hopeless. But understand that Luke, on his traveling from Galilee back down to Judea, and he starts covering Judea at going from one city to the next. This takes about a 6-month time period, I think. Anyway, he does that traveling all over Judea. Matthew and Mark don't mention it, and those are not identical stories to what we find in Capernaum, especially noticing that Luke mentions those same stories earlier. So Luke is not confusing things. He's saying these things happened in Judea, similar things. You'll have to read it to see what I'm talking about. Similar things happened in Judea that had happened in Capernaum, or in his tours in Capernaum. Similar arguments, similar teachings, but they're at a different time. Remember, he taught the same thing in every different town. He'd go to a town, and he'd be teaching the same doctrines. He'd go to the next town, teaching the same doctrines. So it's not at all unusual for a similar type of an argument to happen in the next town you go to. Now, John's is different. John writes much later. He doesn't recount all that information. He just throws in morsels, really juicy morsels. He tells us about his beginning ministry in Judea. He tells us then about the feeding of the 5,000, which is very important because all four Gospels mention the feeding of the 5,000, and that gives you your boundaries. That allows you to know what happened when, because we know that's all the same exact occurrence. And so we know when it happens. John mentions three Passovers. He mentions three Passovers. And it mentions one time where Jesus didn't go to, he was staying away from Judea for fear of the Jews. They wanted to kill him. So he just stayed away. So that's how we calculate that he had a ministry of 3.5 years. Also, people think he had a ministry of 3.5 years because of how many times the prophecies say 3.5 years. 3.5 years, you know, times and a half of a time, or 42 months. So many times that's mentioned in the prophecies. So a lot of preachers, even before we did the itinerary, have come up with the idea that it was 3.5 years. Some people would say there's four feasts mentioned in John, all four of them are Passovers, but the feast in John chapter 5 is not called a Passover. It doesn't say what feast it is. I think he skipped a Passover. I don't think he went to Judea on one of those Passovers. That's how we get the 3.5 years. Anyway, I'm not going to go into all the little details. Just some things are very interesting. If you'll look at them in order, in page 3, starts with his baptism and his temptation. If you'll notice, tell you how I came up with this to start with. I think Jesus was born as a fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles. That means I think he was born in early October. I don't have proof of that. I can see how the Tabernacles fits. And so if that's true, I think he was born in the fall of 5 BC. So I'm talking about sometime around October of 5 BC. He turns 30 in October of, which is the fall of 26 AD. I've got some explanations there. I'm not going to read them right now. he's tempted by the devil. John the Baptist is a month later, he's back still in Bethabara, and Jesus is with them. He mentions him there, and Jesus is dwelling in Bethabara, according to John chapter 1. Then he has the Cana. That's the second section I get here, is Cana and Capernaum visit, which I think is just fascinating that he gives us that information. The third one is in 27 AD, very early. It mentions a Passover. John says they're back in Jerusalem for a Passover. Drives the merchants out of the temple, mentions that. And another thing he does, he mentions that, let me see, where does it say that? I thought I had it on here. Yeah. He mentions that the temple was 46 years in building. You notice that in John chapter 2? He says, destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days. And they say, this temple's been building for 46 years. And we know from Josephus that the temple was begun by Herod in his 18th year or something like that. I've got it written down there. His 18th year of his reign, which he reigned from 37 BC to 4 BC. So it had to have happened in 20 or 19 BC. Add the 46 years to it, 27 AD. Line's exactly right. Now, why don't we use that as a confirmation that these people are telling the truth and that we know what we're talking about, or that they knew what they were talking about? They can find every kind of contradiction to try to discredit the Bible, but when the Bible comes out exact, just right down the line, says this building was 46 years, and we know from other sources when it was begun, and they're actually accurate. Compaginado. What do you call it? Interlocking. It's like all this information interlocks, and it ought to confirm it to all of us. All right. He moves. His first Galilee tour. He leaves Judea, and the first thing he does is he tours the south of Galilee. You'll find out where he went. He first goes to Samaria. You see what it says? 4 months before harvest. That's in John chapter 4. Jesus says, you say there's 4 months till harvest. He says, but I'm telling you the harvest is ready right now. But notice what that gives us information. Jesus is speaking 4 months before harvest. Well, when is harvest? It's a time of year. Harvest is the fall. This is 4 months before harvest. So that's summer. He's in Sychar in Samaria during the summer. So he left Judea after John the Baptist is cast into prison. He leaves Judea in the summer of 27 AD and he gets to Galilee page 4. He reaches Galilee. Notices that he predicts his own dishonor when he gets there. It's interesting because he knows he's going back to Nazareth. He's headed back to Nazareth. But he stops in Cana, and a guy from Capernaum comes and visits him. He does this miracle. They call it his second miracle. John says, that's the second miracle. So this is all early on. He's being chronological. And then it says he continues preaching around about in the synagogues of Galilee, and he becomes famous for the power of the Spirit, and he reaches his hometown Nazareth, and they try to kill him. That's the fourth section. The fifth section is he makes a permanent move to Capernaum. He starts teaching in the Sabbath day. He calls his disciples Simon Peter and Andrew and James and John. And they begin to follow him. Now notice, he knew them already. You read the story in Matthew, or you read the story in Mark, and it looks like he's just walking along the seashore and he sees a couple of fishermen out there and says, hey, you guys, I want you to come and follow me. That's just them knowing the whole story and forgetting to tell us little information. When you find out from the other ones, like John mentions, that Simon Peter began following Jesus while he was doing his Judean ministry. He was over there competing with John the Baptist for disciples, and John the Baptist says, that's the Christ. And Simon Peter and Andrew and Philip and Nathaniel and all them, they leave John the Baptist's group and they start with him. And so when he goes to Capernaum, one of the reasons he went to Capernaum is because he had all these disciples that were from there. So when he goes out on the seaside, after he moves to Capernaum, he goes out to the seaside and says, Simon and Andrew, I want you to leave your father and leave your business, and I want you just to come and follow me. They knew who he was, and they knew he had moved to Capernaum, and they knew he was beginning a ministry, and he comes over there and says, I got something for you to do. And they left their father and said, okay, we'll follow you. This was a big move on their part. And he's building up disciples. He's going to teach them how to preach. He's going to teach them the doctrines. He teaches them the Sermon on the Mount and all that. This is just really fascinating to me. You'll notice that one of the first things he does is he heals Simon's mother-in-law. They have a supper for him. And the mother-in-law is there, and she's sick with a fever, and he heals her. That's mentioned in the others, but you'll notice the order. Pay attention to the order, how that's not mentioned until after the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. Matthew wanted to start with the doctrines and end with the parables. It's not chronological, but the other two are perfectly, almost perfectly chronological. Sixth group is the second Galilee tour. He does it again. Most harmonies would say this is his first one. I see his first tour as when he left Judea, he did a tour. He became famous. Second Galilee tour is where he goes around healing. He prepares the disciples and they go around healing. He becomes famous. All right. The seventh is his Capernaum ministry. He gets done with that tour with his disciples. And it looks like he spends a lot of time then in Capernaum. We know it's at the summer because they're plucking and eating corn. See, if you notice in Matthew 12, Mark 2, and Luke 6, talks about them walking through the fields and his disciples are plucking corn. Now, by the way, that's not our kind of corn. That's wheat or some other kind of there was no American corn in that area. We think of corn just means grain. That's what the word, Old English word corn means. It means grain. So they were walking through the grain, the fields probably of wheat, some kind of a wheat. And they just take the wheat, you know, they break it up in their hands and they just eat it. That's weird. Or maybe it wasn't wheat. Maybe it was something else that they were. Anyway, we know that that's summer. Tells you where he goes. Travels to the city of Nain. Must not be very far because they're still in Capernaum. Let me see. Capernaum lasts quite a while. It goes back to the house. He's back in Capernaum. If you just look at those things, it's all around Capernaum. Then he gets in Mark 6 and in Luke 8, he starts another tour. This is where the apostles go around healing. Anyway. Then in 29 AD, he visits Jerusalem. This is the John 5 one. He gets to Jerusalem and there's a feast. I don't believe it was the Passover feast, because I think John would have mentioned it as the Passover feast. But he gets to Jerusalem and there's a feast going on and these people waiting at the pool, and he gets in trouble because he healed somebody on the Sabbath day. Interesting that John the Baptist is in prison, but he's still alive in John chapter 5. My 10th one is when he returns to Capernaum. He keeps doing his ministry in Capernaum. My 11th one is Jerusalem Feast of Tabernacles. Mentions very, very clearly in John chapter 7, 8, and all the way through 10. That whole thing happens in Jerusalem in the Feast of the Tabernacles. There's narrative connection the entire time in John. It says this happened and that happened and this happened and that happened, this happened and that happened. And it gives you a connection all the way to chapter 10. Then he's back up in Galilee, and my 12th one called the Transfiguration Trip. Interesting, because this Transfiguration Trip is, he goes north and he's up at Caesarea Philippi, and he tells them he's the Christ. The wrong way. That's an interesting section. Now, my 13th one is called Final Departure. I'm on page 7, Final Departure from Galilee. Look at Luke 9:51, and I'll point out what I had already told you a little bit about. Okay, he says, and it came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up. Notice he's thinking, this is in late 29, we're in winter, wait, final departure from Galilee. We know that the winter Jerusalem Feast of Dedication in 29. So this is 29, sometime after the summer, but before winter. He should be received up. I'm in verse 51 of John 9. He was be received up. He steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. Notice he's heading toward Judea, and he goes through this village in Samaria. What's going on? There is a mention of him being in Samaria again in Luke 17. Seems like it's out of order. Makes a lot of sense for it to be put right here, because he's going through Samaria. He has some problems in the city. He heals some some lepers. Well, I don't know what's going on. My throat. All right. From here on, Luke starts what we call Luke's gnomology. I've thrown in some of the stories of John the Baptist because they have to fit somewhere. And 29, we know that the Feast of the Dedication is in winter. So when he leaves Galilee and he starts his tour of Judea, just beginning, he just goes through Galilee. He gets, down to visit Bethany, and they go ahead and go over to the Feast of Dedication. And that's when they raise Lazarus. I'm thinking they raise Lazarus sometime in the winter of 30 AD. He continues his Judean tour in in what I have my 16. Oh, good grief. My 16th division or group. This is where he's, all this is mostly in Luke. You'll find very seldom something's mentioned. Like when he argues with the Pharisees about divorce in chapter 19 of Matthew. Remember Matthew 19, he argues with the Pharisees about divorce. That's mentioned in Luke's nomology, but that's about the only connection that you find. You don't find anything in Matthew or Mark until you get to them in the house. He receives the infants. That's way down close to the bottom of the page. He receives the infants. And from here on, there's almost no disagreement between the Gospels. So in the spring of 30 is his final ascent. He's getting ready to go up to for the Passover. And I'm not going to go into that. The 18th division I have is the week before Passover. And I divided it. I don't think it's on y'all's. I have it divided here. The 19th is his passion. That starts on the Wednesday. Some people think it starts on Friday, and that's fine. If it starts on Friday, you got to move some of the days up. And then the 20th is the resurrection narrative. If you guys want to study something, study that resurrection narrative. I've got them all divided up in what order they had to have happened in. If you read them separately, you think it's hopeless. But if you really study it out and look what they each say, you find out it's not hopeless, and every one of them's giving you information. If you see on your columns how the resurrection narrative is all, oh man, see it's all jumbled? It's like they each one includes something the other one doesn't include. But if you put them in that order, the order that it's got there, and they're all in order, they're just inserting information from others there. I think there's only one thing out of order in the whole resurrection narrative. But I think it's fantastic. It actually works. Tells you everything that happens after the resurrection narrative. He rises again from the dead, and then all these things happen. And it's, I don't know. It's fascinating to me. This is years of work. Summarized, and it's all there. And that allows me to tell to figure out what's happening, where they are, and what's next, what period of his ministry it is. I think it was 3.5 years. It's possible to work it and make it 2.5 years, but it makes it really hard. You got to fit a whole bunch of stuff into one little summer, and I don't think it could happen. So I divided it into 2 summers. But anyway, any questions? Man, that's fascinating to me.
There's a ton of information.
There is a lot of information there.
Yeah. When you were at first explaining everything, I was thinking of that map that they do. And what is that movie? It's a kid's movie. The Emperor's New Groove. And you have that little map scene where they're like,
I haven't seen that movie, so I don't know. There's a map scene.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Does that mean, like, you know, I don't know what he's talking about? That sort of thing?
No, like, are you saying about, like, how much?
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
I kind of remember it.
Wait, what were you... You mentioned something about... Something about that Mark was different, and I did have a question, and I can't remember it now.
Mark has, you mean as far as the synoptics go, Mark has fewer stories, but more detail in the stories it has.
No, you said something
about...
Who's
Matthew? You said you were
going to
get to it later.
Well, let me think. Matthew. Yeah, Matthew and Mark joined back in. Luke talks about a whole lot. It's one of the big mysteries. In my mind, it's not a mystery. Luke is talking about a Judean tour, and that's like seven chapters of Luke that the other two don't mention. And they join in at the same time when he receives the infants, and they're already close to Jerusalem. I don't remember if they're in Jericho or where it says it, but it's all the information is there. I don't think there's any chronological disparity there at all. I think it lines up perfectly. And another thing is, taking Luke's nomology, taking those six or seven chapters of Luke and making them a Judean ministry, just exactly like Luke says it, just exactly what Luke says. Don't try to take each of those little stories and fit them in somewhere else and then say Luke's way out of order. No, Luke's in order. He gives the last 6 months of Jesus' ministry in Judea that the others just skip. The others say he decided to leave Galilee, and then he's in Jerusalem, and he receives the infants, and that's how it goes. And he has these arguments with the Pharisees. They just skipped over all the, because it's a lot of similar stuff that they did in Judea after they did it in Galilee. To me, that solves that problem. In my mind, the discrepancies of the Gospels are resolved if you just put them in the kind of order that they work. It's possible that something's wrong, needs to be corrected or what have you, but for the most part, it's like a revelation to me. Wow, it's there, it's clear, you guys have it. You want to find out when this might have happened, you can find out exactly where it happens in the narrative. And most of them are in order. Matthew's not in order from chapter 8 through 12. It seems like it's in a different kind of order, not a chronological order. He's dealing with certain issues.
Thank you for giving this to us.
Yes, it's worth millions of dollars. It's.
I'm sorry, I don't know. How many of the disciples do you think were also John's followers first?
All of them.
All of them?
All of them without exception. Because Acts chapter 1 says, of those 12 apostles, he says, we're going to have to appoint somebody to take Judas's place, and he has to fulfill this requirement. He has to have been with us since the baptism of John. So they all were with John the Baptist when Jesus was baptized. From that on, all of the apostles were disciples of John the Baptist first. From that, it's a proof text, I know. I don't have anything against proof texts. It's information. You get information from a verse, and that becomes a proof text. And Peter said, for Matthias to be chosen, he had to have been with us like all of us were, from the baptism of John to the day he was taken up from us. That's what the witnesses were. They wanted to witness the entire ministry. Those 12 apostles witnessed the entire ministry. There were a bunch of others that witnessed certain things, but those 12 apostles were chosen specifically to witness the whole ministry from the baptism of John all the way to the ascension. Okay, well, if there's no questions, I guess we'll just pray and close out. Lord, thank you. Love your word. It's fascinating to us, Lord. It's the glory of God to conceal a matter, and it's the thrill of kings to search it out. That's what we're doing, Lord. We just love searching your word, figuring things out. And we know that it's a spiritual book to teach us and to help us. Give us clarity, God. Help us to live it. Help us to know it. I ask you to remember our children. Help them to hunger after it. In Jesus' name. Amen. All righty.